Hey, good evening, everybody. Welcome. John Henry Soder here along with George Batista. He's either on that side or that side, wherever he is this week. We're very excited today. Oh, man, I am so happy. We have David Sanchez on the show this evening. And wait till you hear about David, because it's going to be going to blow your mind. And we've been listening to him for years, and I guarantee that you have too. So hang out. All right, we are back after our amazing theme song that I love to dance to. George, you know what happens? I start talking, so why don't you just tell us a little bit about our guests, and then we'll bring them on and rock and roll.
Absolutely. This is so exciting, and I'm such a fan here. So David Sanchez is long regarded as one of the premier musicians in the world. David was one of the original members of the Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, has also toured and recorded with the likes of Peter Gabriel, Sting, Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Santana, Seal, and a long list of A-level musicians. He also created groundbreaking music with his own band called Tone. In 2014, Sanchez was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a member of the E Street Band. In 2020, David released his 10th album called Eyes Wide Open, which also featured legendary names as Vinnie Colaiuta, Will Calhoun, and Prince alumni Michael Bland. That album is a mix of four vocal and four instrumental compositions, and is also a movie for the ears, addressing today's issues head-on through David's signature sound, and we are honored to have him on this program. So let's bring him up, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. David Sanchez.
Hey, everybody. David.
There he is. All
right. And of course, I pronounce the name Sanchez because I'm cheesy. But you know,
that's okay. Over the years, it's gotten many different. most of them are acceptable. That's
yeah,
okay.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. We're really honored to have you here. We've heard you play for so many years. I know I saw you with Eric Clapton some point in the '90s at the Garden. I think it was.
Yeah, it was. Yep.
And incredible show. And just one of those things that, you know, I always tell people, I was like, you know, you've definitely heard him play. Your ears have absorbed the sounds that he creates. And that to me is always a joy to have people on that have such an impact musically, emotionally, and spiritually. And so we're going to start some questions. We are live. So if anybody's out there want to ask some questions, you can shoot them into the box there. George is going to start with our first question. George.
Yes. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on. By the way, I think the first time we actually saw him, John, was with Sting. I think it was the 10 Summoners Tales tour in the early 90s.
Yes.
And that was a great, you know, that was one of my favorite bands because it was just you four guys, right?
As a quartet, I got to say that was the best quartet I've ever been in.
It was one of my favorite of Sting's bands, actually, because it was like a four-piece rock band. You guys just rocked it out, which was amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely. But so, you know, obviously you're a multi-instrumentalist. Who were your early inspirations growing up musically?
My earliest inspirations growing up musically, let's say for piano. Mm-hmm. I have three pianists that I really, really focused on and that inspired me a lot. And that would be Keith Jarrett, mm-hmm. Herbie Hancock, and Chick Corea.
Oh, yeah.
Those three pianists were like my sort of, guidepost. I'm still trying to get it together based on their music and their incredible inventiveness on piano. Yeah. So for keyboards, that was it. For guitar, I was really into Jimi Hendrix, of course, and Jeff Beck, but B.B. King was my first electric guitar. My father was a big B.B. King fan, and he had all of his albums and stuff, and we would sit around on the weekends and, you know, play records, and he would point out different things to me, you know, different sounds and different... My father was really good at pointing out where the good, where a good solo was coming.
Oh, nice.
We used to listen to organ music, like Hammond organ players, like Jimmy Smith and Jack McDuff and all that stuff. And again, he knew all that stuff. And we used to go to Asbury Park. There was a place called the Orchid Lounge. And all those people came through there. All those organ players at the time came through there. So we, between having the records at home to listen to and then getting to see them live sometimes, but he would, we'd be listening to a song and he'd go, hey, all right, David, listen, there's a good solo coming up. It's like, wow, I need to, this is where it starts.
That was
inspirational to me as well.
That's so cool. I think it's so important that parents do that. Like, I have two kids and I'm constantly, come here, you got to listen to this. Pay attention. I don't know if you're going to go in that direction, but it's so important. And, you know, we talk a lot about the music industry and where it's going and where it's whatever. Yeah. And one of the things that we talk about, and I think we've mentioned it on almost every show when we've had a musician on, was that there was an article written in the Atlantic about how 70% of the music that's streamed today on Spotify is older music.
Mm-hmm.
So meaning that most of everything that's being streamed is stuff that's 30 years old or more, meaning that the stuff that's currently being produced sort of does not have the shelf life of things that were just created. And it's a very interesting article. It's on Atlantic. And so what are your thoughts on that? Because you were listening to the best of the best coming in, you know, through this whole. And
you know, that's an interesting statistic that you just said. I didn't know that. But it works to my advantage because a lot of music that I'm on apparently is getting played a lot. So
yes, absolutely.
It works well for me as far as royalty. Exactly. Well, like that. But yeah, I know, you know, it's the music industry is so completely different from and was when I got in the 70s. I got my first record contract, I think it was 1976 or something like that, 75, somewhere in there. And just the structure, the economic structure of it, like who gets paid what and why, and you know, of course, the advent of digital audio and everything that just completely uprooted the whole system, and the fact that once anything is digitized, whether it's music or you know, artwork or whatever, once it's digitized, it's free. It's free to anyone who wants to take it for free, you know.
Right.
And it's a huge problem for people. I mean, controlling your own copyright is very difficult, if not impossible these days. It's very tough.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, piggybacking on that and in my discussions with John regarding that whole concept was back in the 70s, 60s, 70s, there was, you know, you had the whole British invasion, you had, there was so much competition. You had to be on your game with songwriting and creating music and that type of thing.
Right.
And, you know, so everybody was trying to up each other, whether it was Led Zeppelin all the way to Clapton, all the way to whoever it was. And, you know, sitting down and writing a song back then, you know, think people like Jackson Browne would sit down on the piano and take hours to just kind of just bring out this beautiful piece, where nowadays it's so much different because you have TikTok, you have all these things where somebody could just do something in 2 seconds and there it is, you know.
You know, it's almost like if you bought the right piece of software and pushed the right button at the right time,
exactly,
you got something, you know.
Right.
That way, that's the state of what's the state of music software these days.
Yeah,
and you can just do insanely, you know, put together things on your laptop even without being in a sophisticated studio. But there's a change in the way that people write. Kind of going back to what you're saying, it's not even created with the same sort of. I don't want to say it wrong here. It's just an energy. There's a lack of spontaneity and a lack of sort of Like when I listen to his new music on the radio, excuse me, I hear like chunks of things, like a snippet, like a little a phrase, you know, mm-hmm. a 2-bar phrase, a 3-bar, 4-bar phrase, whatever. I hear that. And it could be good. It could be, oh, that's interesting musically. It's a nice melody, whatever. And then I hear another phrase connected to it of equal length, maybe another little snippet, 4 bars, whatever. And then I hear it going back to the other. It's basically this combination of little individual things that don't have an organic sense of that they belong together, or that flows from one thing to another. Here's one interesting little thing. Very cool. Sounds good. Now here's another thing that I'll say something else. We go back to the other thing. But it also, to me, this is a real criticism, I think, in like modern composing, let's say pop music, let's limit it to popular music that you hear on the radio, okay? It is dynamically, it's just sterile. It's monodynamic.
Right.
It's like whatever dynamic the song starts out on, that's how it's going to end up on. That's how it's going to sound in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lack of, I don't know, just a lack of flow to me, a lack of dynamics, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely.
The whole song is just the same dynamic level from start to end, pow, and that's it.
Right.
I find that too much modern music, let's say written by young people,
you know? Yeah, I look at it as like what you were saying about the purpose of why Jackson Browne sat there is different than the purpose of whoever is on TikTok trying to come up with those phrases. You know, I think the purpose, the reason why they're there, you know, I mean, you're sitting there pouring out your heart or your guts to this piece of music because you have to, because it's coming through you and you feel it. And right. then you have the TikTok, you know, you basically all you need to do is have like a good piece of software and then you got to do this. You got this down.
Yeah.
And if you're pretty and you got
you're in.
You know? You're in. And it's really frightening what it is. And we talk a lot about it because it's, you know, we're musicians and we love music. And you know, it's also like digesting. We're not digesting anything new unless, I mean, you have to go out and really find stuff. Yeah. And there is great music being made right now.
Oh, there's some, I've heard great music interesting being made. Stuff. That's true. It's not, I don't mean to.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, brush, you know, it's not on.
Everything new and modern is like what I'm saying, but because I really have heard some outstanding, interesting stuff, but that's sort of, it's a bit more in the minority of our experience, but it is out there for sure.
Yeah, you have to search for it. And,
I think too, what's different with kids, I'll call them kids, so say with younger artists of this generation, there's more of a push as a competition to be famous as opposed to a competition to be a better musician.
You're right. Yep.
You know, and I think people from my generation and all that was the focus. I think we didn't have the distraction of social media. I think social media is quite damaging, frankly.
Yeah.
I really do. I think it's doing quite a lot of damage to a lot of things, to society, to people's attention spans, to all kinds of stuff. But we did not have that distraction. And the younger musicians, this generation, they're better at business than we were. Right. They're much better business people.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They're much better business people and marketers. You know, they know how to market themselves. But I think in a lot of times, in the quest to market yourself, you can lose yourself.
Right, because that's the focus.
You can become so focused on marketing yourself winning that you forget your focus on your own creativity and growth, you know?
Yeah. Like I'll see someone with like 100,000 followers and I'm like, wow, an artist with 100,000 followers. I go listen. It's nothing interesting. You know, it is what it is. Mm. And that's about it.
everyone following someone like, 100,000 followers.
Yeah.
Does that equal $100,000?
Is right.
every follower?
Like, what does that mean?
Show up as a dollar? I don't know.
And you know, I work in social media actually, so I'm sort of like in it. And I know that you can, if you use it for business, and I use it to help other businesses and artists kind of promote their business, their stuff. But really, it damages people in the sense that it makes you famous in your own little world. You think you're famous. You have these 100,000 followers. You put out a little video of you doing this. I keep doing the same move. That's my go-to. But if you keep doing this, you get 10,000 likes and thumbs up, and you suddenly feel like this instant gratification, which is extremely damaging.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, it's damaging in your head. And if that doesn't equate to something significant in your checkbook, bank account, what is the point?
You're right.
Yeah, it's just all a sort of egoic gratification.
Yeah, it's digital. Something. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. But you know, and I've had management. I am working with a manager in Nashville, John McCracken, on this last album, Eyes Wide Open, and he was really instrumental in getting me all set up and getting everything I need to make the record available. But I go the other way with social media. It's like I will hire people to do that for me. And there's a certain part that, of course, I have to do myself. If I'm doing promotions for, the record, I did some promotion when it came out and when we started selling merchandise and all that kind of stuff. I'll do that and I'll do it well. I don't have a problem doing it. But what I have a big problem with is doing it over and over and over and over again on the same thing in order to, like, you know, apparently reach people, to spread it out, to keep yourself, you know, always posting, you know, and is that going to translate really, truly into sales? For some people, it does.
Yeah. Some, I mean, it's a tool.
Yeah. But I, you know, they're not happy with me about how much I'm not on social media. No, seriously, they're not happy with me at all.
They're like, David, come on, do a TikTok.
Yeah, well
David, if you want, feel free to use this.
They definitely want me to be more. And apparently me or my fans and everything. Once it gets past a certain point of the record being out, again, even my fans, I appreciate everyone who wants to call themselves a fan of mine and has done anything or gotten anything out of my music that I've done. But I'm not the guy who's going to be on the fan page every day too and interacting with fans.
Right.
You know, again, the point of people telling me that is, well, if you do that, you're going to sell more records. Well, yeah, maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, it's like, here's the other thing too. Truth be told, some bright spark actually bought the CD of Eyes Wide Open when it came out in March of 2020 and proceeded to post the whole record on the internet.
Oh,
wow.
Within the first 2 months. So, you know, we've got a website up there with merchandise and it's on different, you know, formats, streaming formats and places you can get and everything, but it's on the internet for free. Just have it, you know, the whole record. I remember I called my friend Ernest Carter, who was in the E Street Band with me for a while, and just touching base and saying, hey, you know, what's up? I'm going to send you this new record. And he goes, oh, wait, I've already heard it.
Oh, man.
He knew I had put something out because he'd already seen it and heard it. I sent him a record anyway. So it's just kind of, I have a hard time sort of feeding something that I think is just ripping me off every day.
Right. Sure,
you know,
sure.
I've been robbed by this system and I'm supposed to just be in it every day knowing that that goes on. As we speak right now, there's sites up there that say they're me, they're not me. You know, people just put stuff up to get pictures, they put snippets of music, concert footage, you know, from anywhere they can find it.
Yeah.
And it's not right. It's not me. And they even monetize it to the point where, you know, if they're taking ads and everything, you know, I would like very much to sue. There's about three people. I'd like to sue them, but I don't, at this moment in time, I don't have the financial resources to do that. I'm focused on other things right now. But, you know, one day I'm going to try and figure out how I'm going to release this next record. I'm already working on the follow-up to Eyes Wide Open is called Prisoners of Consciousness.
Nice.
And a lot of it is, I was able to record a lot of the basic tracks in Woodstock before I moved here to Hawaii in my old studio. I had a really large studio. So I think probably the better part of it is actually basic track wise is recorded. But now I'm going to, you know, take my time and flesh it out and, you know, finish it off.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways that you can release it to protect the music. You know, there's different, it's technology driven with the blockchain and all those words that people hear. Mm-hmm. There, and this way it'll go directly to you. They can't actually, but the problem is, you know, we have these cell phones where somebody really just wanted to just put the recorder onto the speaker while it plays from Spotify or wherever, and then everybody gets it. So, you know, what we always say is that when all this technology stuff goes away, skill, ability is going to really rule everything. You know, I mean, it's going to be, people are going to have to learn how to actually create music, and people are going to have to listen to go out and pay money to hear someone actually perform.
Right.
You know, the way it should be.
Right, absolutely. So, growing up playing, I mean, I know you were playing when you were very young, right? And obviously your dad introduced you to a lot of music and that type of thing, which is great. So was music the one and only thing for you? Was there any time where there was any doubt that you would do, or you would do anything else or anything like that? Or was just that one thing?
No, it was music from an age of, I would say, like six.
Wow.
From when I first got to play a piano. We moved from Asbury Park to Belmar, which is about 8 miles away, but it's a smaller town, but it's nicer, it's safer. We had a better house. And there was a piano in the house as part of the sale. The owners
Wow.
Nice.
So my mother sat down at the piano and just blew my mind. I had no idea she could do that.
Wow.
So that was the start of it, really. But yeah, since about age six, seven, I briefly, when I was about 9 years old, I thought maybe it would be nice that I could be a lawyer, a defense lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I just got enamored of, like, there were shows back then in the 50s and 60s, of shows like Perry Mason
yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff where, you know, saving the innocent person. But, you know, you get older and you realize that most people are just, they're guilty. Most of them are guilty. I don't think that's going to be good.
Especially on those shows.
So, but that was just a brief thing. But no, really, from about the age of six, seven, I knew I was going to. My mother and my piano teacher thought that I was going to be a classical recital pianist.
Oh, okay.
The first music that I really learned and started to study was classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And for a young kid, I was making a lot of, according to them, I was making a lot of progress with it. So they both thought, oh, he'll be like a recital pianist and then maybe teach or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there were too many other forms of music that I fell in love with at the same time.
Right.
You know,
right.
Rock and roll and jazz and R&B and everything that was a thing. You know? So, but yeah, it was always music, and I never, to this day, I don't regret the choice, you know. It's not always easy. It hasn't always been easy. There's, to this day, there's challenges and things that we'll have to deal with, man.
Yeah.
Because of the choice you made to be an artist with your life, and, you know, but no, it's working out well.
Yeah, I was gonna say. At least you don't have somebody saying, "Hey, are you eventually gonna get a job or what?"
Yeah,
when you get a real job.
Real job. Yeah.
Right.
That's what Bruce and I used to. We used to laugh and tease about it. He said it in interviews with Bruce Springsteen. He'll say, like, "That's why we're musicians and artists, because we don't want to have real jobs."
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
Don't want a real life, just want a job that
doing horrible something thought.
I'm really not crazy about, and then I might not even be good at it. You know. So.
Well, Bruce, during the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. He mentioned that he met you at 16 years old.
Yes. Yeah.
That's like unbelievable.
I kind of think technically he might have met me in my summer of my 15th year, but yeah.
Wow.
It was summertime for sure. I remember that. It was summertime. And I had walked to Upstage, this music club in Asbury Park, in order to just get into, see if I could get into a jam session or something. And that's where I met him.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was definitely, I probably was, yeah, I was either 15 or 16. I quit school when I was 15 years old. I quit high school.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't know that I could. I was very unhappy in school, very, very, very unhappy in school. And I went to a high school where I was, let's see, there was a 500 kids in this high school, and there were 23 black kids. And oh, wow. I was one of those kids who got bussed 20 miles every day in high school, back and forth. And I was very unhappy with the situation. That's too much unhappiness to go into.
Sure,
but
sure.
It was a history class one day, and he was talking about the Civil War and the whole slavery period. And he said something that made me feel like it was a bit of a whitewash of the situation. Like, you're not really dealing with this serious situation in a serious way. And I said something to him, and we got into a sort of verbal back and forth in the class.
Wow.
He was talking about a fact or something that I knew wasn't factual, because we had a great library in our house, and my mother was a school teacher for all of her life.
Wow.
And so we had multiple books about history and encyclopedias and all kind of stuff. So anyway, he didn't like the fact that I was challenging what he said. And it got even more heated, and he ended up kicking me out of the class.
Wow.
Yeah. He told me to go to the office. And it was interesting, because the other kids, the other few black kids in that class at the same time were like really, they knew what I was saying, and they were amazed that anybody's going to stand up and do it. So he kicks me out of class. And I think he told me to go. If you kick you out of class, they normally tell you to go to the principal's office. Mm-hmm. Somehow, I don't know if this was on my own thing. Maybe they sent me to the principal's office, and then the principal's office sent me to the guidance office. Okay, guidance counselor. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
So this guidance counselor back then, it must have been her first teaching assignment. She had to be like just barely 20, 21, old enough to teach, whatever. And I tell her what happened and how unhappy I am with the situation. I hate coming here, and I hate being taught by these particular people. And she said, well, you know, if you're that unhappy, you can quit. She said, you can, no, here was the thing. You could quit without your parents' permission.
Whoa.
In the state of New Jersey back then, and I was every second of 15 years old. I wasn't 16, 17, or 18 or anything. And I said, really? Like, you know, seriously? She said, yes. And I said, show me. What do I start? And sure enough, and that day, after I signed this piece of paper, I walked out of the front of the high school, right past the principal's office. You know, it's like, I'm out of here. Don't you dare talk to me. You know, I'm done. Now, listen, I'm saying all that to say I don't recommend that to anyone. Nowadays, that was me in my situation.
Now, you heard it here first, kids.
There's educational opportunities that are much, much better today. And sure, I highly suggest that you get an education and enjoy getting your education and, you know, and use it to your advantage. It's just that's how it worked out for me, which allowed me, once I did that, I was free every day of the week. It wasn't just like on the weekends, could I play music and hook up with other people? It was like, that's all I wanted to do. And I met him, and the first time that we started playing together, that was a jam session that went on for about maybe 3 or 4 hours. It started at midnight and ended at by maybe 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, with different people coming in and out. Yeah, it was crazy.
But, that's how long his shows are nowadays.
Yeah, that was our first meeting, and he said he's putting together a new band, and would I be interested in being in that? And of course, yeah, I just want to be in a band, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So that worked out good.
What was it about Bruce that you saw? Because we talk about this also, like the award, the American Idol shows, and all these other shows that you see today.
Yeah.
If Bruce walked in today to audition for these shows, or Bob Dylan, or Neil Young, right. or the list goes on.
Yeah.
I mean, what are we going to have, for Christ's
sake? Yeah, they tell him to come back and work on it somewhere.
Exactly.
Can you imagine? You know, there's a park.
They were trying to get him to sound like something else that already exists.
Right.
Correct.
Right. You know, sound more like this and take your cue from this and that. No, the thing about Bruce is his originality. And what I liked about him most, especially back then, he refused to do covers, to do the traditional band music.
I love that.
At one point, the E Street Band did not do covers. It was all his music that he was working on getting together, which
I didn't know that.
Successful, yeah. No, we couldn't. And at one point, we couldn't get work in New Jersey clubs. Because the club owners wanted you to be basically like a jukebox.
Right.
They wanted to be able people call out covers and you just jump on it. And we didn't want to do that.
Yeah, it's still like that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah. I mean, I live in Nashville now, but I lived in New Jersey for a long time. And I was surprised because I'm originally from New York. And I remember going to the clubs in Georgia, and when we were playing the clubs, a lot of it was original music. There was no... We would hear somebody do a cover and we'd be like, why are you doing that song? Like, you got a lot of nerve. You know?
Like badly.
Right, badly. Yeah, exactly.
It's not a great deal. The song you're covering actually sounds a lot better than that.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then in New Jersey, it was all covers. And then here in Nashville, there's a combination. And depending on where you go, if you go to Broadway down in Crazyville, where I call it, it's all covers, you know. But that's very interesting that nobody was against Bruce because his material was just so captivating and so interesting.
Yeah, the people didn't have any problem with it. The audience, it was just the club owners, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
At one point.
Wow.
Unbelievable. So how was it when you guys got inducted into that? I mean, how was the feeling? You know, how did you feel about it? Was it just one of those things like, holy cow, you know, this is where everything came to, you know?
Well, that was one of the most amazing nights of my life. I'll never forget it for the reason of the honor of being inducted and being part of the E Street Band. But at that same night, Peter Gabriel also got inducted.
That's right. You worked with
him. I got called to play with him. I'm the keyboard player in his touring band. So it's like, okay, you're going to rehearse and play two songs of Bruce, and you're also going to play two songs of Peter Gabriel. It's like, whoa.
That's
another connection. You know, the fact that Peter and I, we've known each other since the 70s, Peter Gabriel and I.
Wow.
And, you know, worked together on tours since 86 was the Soul Tour, I believe, 86, 87. So, you know, for both of us to get inducted on the same night, it was pretty wild. So, and it was great doing the double duty. I was able to do it. It was great fun. I got to see everybody again for a minute. And, it was just like music camp. My backstage was crazy. I had to go from one dressing room for Bruce to the other dressing room for Peter. And in the course of doing all that, I had move my clothes all over the place. And, you know, people are walking by. Here comes Sheryl Crow, and she's singing. She says, oh, David, you look so good. So happy to see you. Congratulations. And you're chatting with people like that. You know, it was just a great night between the energy of the night itself and the honor of it all. And, you know, the fact that we were just able to all be together and enjoy that. It was great.
That's amazing. Did you know Peter before or after Genesis?
I knew Peter when he left Genesis.
The way
I know Peter is he had heard my first album, Forest of Feelings, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think was 75 or something. I don't know, 76, 75, somewhere. Anyway, I get a phone call from the record company, which was Epic Records. And they say, listen, we have a telegram. So, we have a telegram for you from Peter Gabriel. And I go, really? I go, what's up? So they tell me, well, he has left Genesis and he's doing his first album. What was his producer's name? Bob Ezrin. Mm-hmm. And he really heard your music. He's looking for a keyboard player. He wants to know if you'd be interested in playing keyboards on his album. Wow. So Peter actually flew to New York and I said, yes, of course I'm interested. So he flew to New York and we met. I was living in Long Branch, New Jersey at the time. And he actually took a train down from New York and brought his music, played me a bunch of songs. He stayed at my apartment for a bit and, you know, played me what was ended up being some of the songs on his first album. And the plan was to, they wanted me to do the keyboards on it, and they were going to record in Canada. And we, the record company back then would put you on a pretty rigorous touring schedule. They give you a budget. Here's your budget. You got 6 weeks to make this album, your next, whatever you want to say. You got 6 weeks to make it, and then out on the road. And they would put you everywhere. We would open for, we opened for Hall & Oates. We opened for Jan Hammer. All kinds of, you know, different things that we were on the road. So we had the schedule, and it worked out at one point. Management was trying to get the whole band. I think Peter wanted me specifically to do keyboards on the record and the producer as well. But the management was trying to get the drummer to, trying to make it like a band package deal or something. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, that didn't work out. But then they said, look, we can't. Their recording schedule in Canada was in total conflict with our touring schedule because we had just, you know, put out a record and he's like, you guys, you cannot not tour. So that didn't happen, but we stayed in touch. You know, we stayed in touch all those years. Every time he played in New York, I would get a phone call and free couple of tickets to come wherever he was. It was like Boston, New York, anywhere on the East Coast, say. And anytime I happened to be in London or something, found a way to get in touch. So over the years, it was just like that. And then he did the So album. And I got a phone call saying, look, Peter wants to change the band. He wants to change keyboard player and the drummer. Although Manu Katché did play on the album. I did all the touring. I didn't play on the So album. Mm-hmm. And then that was the beginning of, rehearsals for the Soul Tour. We did a gig at United Nations, which was one kind of, I'm trying to think who it was. We had El Shankar, the violinist, was a guest. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. It was El Shankar, myself, and everybody, David Rhodes and Peter and Tony Levin and and Manu, I believe.
Wow.
But
I'm always fascinated because when you're in that world, right, it's a world that very few people actually live in, as far as the touring and then the records and the studios and all the that comes with it.
Yeah.
Staying focused, and I'm always fascinated by artists in general because there is that quiet time of playing, rehearsing, making sure that you got your chops up ready for the tour, ready for the recording. And it's always that moment that people, this is part of the problem with the TikTok thing where it's this instant thing where it's like, come on, man, how much did you work on that? you took 10 minutes for your moves. Sure. Talk a little bit about like the mindset that you have to really dive into that world and to stay focused because there's so many artists as we all know, unfortunately take the wrong turn or they just get consumed by all this other stuff.
Well, as far as your attention span and focus, I remember the first tour, I think it was the first tour that Manu and I did with Peter. It had to be the So tour, which was in 86 getting started. And we had a conversation about music and memory. There's a lot of music to remember on a Peter Gabriel tour, a Sting tour, there's several albums worth of songs that you're going to have to learn and remember because there's no sheet music on stage, charts are like not.
You're going to have somebody turn.
I hate that anyway. I hate attempting to like read a chart live where you're like, no. So it is something, a lot of memory. And so one time we were standing backstage or something and just talking about it, about what we were listening to musically. And I said, personally, I'm not listening to any other music except this until we're like 2 weeks in. Oh, and he said the same thing. He was like, oh yeah, me too. He says, I'm not listening to anything else. I'm not casually filling up my brain with like other songs and chords. He goes, this is all I'm listening to for a while. And maybe after like 2 weeks in, when you really feel like, then you could, but no.
Yeah.
So it's just like that. It is, there is a part where you have to be hyper-focused on the memory part. Also, like, there's plenty of room for things to change expressions. Like, a lot of really good things would happen in rehearsal, say, between what Sting might want to happen and what Vinny actually came up with.
Right.
A combination of an idea, or it was this groove that Vinny had, but then Dominic will have like a changes things subtly. It's just, it kind of goes around like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I can come up with a different inversion of the same chord, you know? There's so many ways to play any single chord, man, you know?
Right.
It's got all these different exotic inversions. And so it just kind of comes up like that. So what rehearsal to me is fun. I like rehearsing, and I love sound checks on the road. Sound check is like a party before the show, the real party. The sound check is like little, like not an after party, it's like a little pre-party.
Yeah.
You know, you can get really set up and get a sense of the room you're playing in, make sure that your stuff is all perfectly like you want it to be.
Yeah.
And then have a great sound check. And, you know, it's just fun. A half hour sound check, 45 minutes. Boom, get out of there, go back to the hotel, come back in showtime and hit it. And it's just, it's fun.
Wow. That 10 Sumner's Tale album, that whole tour was just,
yeah.
Just, I mean, that's a lot of memory.
That was really one of the best records and one of the best tours that I did. That was a very special time.
Yeah, that's always been my favorite Sting.
Yeah, me too.
Album.
Yeah,
that's one of mine too.
Me and George, I think we used to just have it on in the room.
Yes,
I think every song on it. I think something like, with the exception of maybe two songs, they were like hits.
They were all great songs.
Hits at some point.
I would spend countless hours trying to learn that 7 days that Vinny does on that.
Oh yeah.
On that group, it's just fantastic.
I don't even know what the countdown that is.
I know it's incredible. But speaking of Vinny, who's another gentleman, by the way, would love to have him on this program as well. He was on your latest record, and you had some great musicians on that record, great drummers on that. Will Calhoun as well.
Yeah.
I got to meet Will once, which was really, really cool. So in writing that record, as far as the drummers go, did you have a vision of what you wanted, or was it kind of just left up to them?
Both.
Okay.
Both. Yeah, it was both, really. I had a definite vision of what I wanted, the kind of feel that I wanted. But again, they had total freedom to sort of interpret that, you know? Mm-hmm. It was very much both. I definitely had a vision, but they brought their own interpretive thing to it, you know? And
nice.
It's good. I like to work that way. I don't like to sort of pin somebody down so much, to be so hyper specific about a certain thing that there's no room for their creativity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
I don't like to do that. But and those guys are all so good. And also Adriano Molinari,
right,
who's fantastic drummer, mm-hmm. who I met working with Zucchero in Italy many years ago. He was an amazing musician. Adriano is incredible.
The record.
Yeah.
Yep, there it is.
It was fun. Yeah, it was fun. I kind of like somebody said that to me. I think also Joe Bonadio. Joe was my improvising partner. I used to do solo concerts where there would be myself, and I would sometimes just myself and a synthesizer and guitar, but I would also have a percussionist. And Joe Bonadio and I did a bunch of shows on the East Coast together, and we can really, really improvise well together. And he's a fantastic drummer, and also a really good producer. But that was the same thing with Will, always, I would say. You know the song, Middle of the Night? It's a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, the groove on that is insane.
Yes.
Will,
it was like, okay. I wrote the song to a loop. It's like a hip hop.
Okay. Right? Okay.
And it's a decent sounding loop. It sounds like it's a nice hip hop sounding loop. It really worked good. But when I got Will to come up to the house and put real drums on it, I said, yeah, I want to lose the loop and just, you know, you do your thing, you know? And he said, I don't know, man, the loop's kind of hip. How about if you keep the loop in and let me do some other stuff around it. Check it out. That was totally his response to my saying, okay, wow. here's total freedom.
Look at that.
Well, but he dug some elements of that. So the groove on that record is like the loop. And then he played bass drum, tom-toms, and at the same time,
cymbals, yeah. Yeah.
And oh my God. And then that combined with the loop, it was like, man, that's Africa Square.
Yeah.
You know, because that's like stuff from like Mali. You know?
Yeah.
He studied in Mali.
Right.
He did. He studied with master musicians in Mali and also in Australia and with some Aboriginal folks. And he knows that stuff inside out. But I could not believe it. It was like, man, I didn't hear that. I mean, that would have been a surprise if he could have just said, yeah, okay, let's lose the loop.
Right.
And he actually could have done it, you know, probably found a way to done that whole thing.
Yeah.
But it was the syncopation of the loop and then his part. But that, to this day, when I listen to that that double ride cymbal on
what
the bell,
a groove.
And he just like lights it up, man. I've never heard anything like that.
So. That's unbelievable. I mean, it has to do with the fact that, yes, great musicians, but also confidence within the room. You know, it's like if you don't have that stressful environment, you're allowed to think and to be free and to say, oh, you know, I do like that loop, you know. But somebody that would have come into a tent and go, I just had this loop here, but I'm going to take it out. Now you do your thing. You know, if it was a little bit more stressful, then it would have been – and it would have been probably just as good. You know, I'm not saying
– I think so, but it's just that he heard it. He heard the rhythmic possibility of the two of those things together.
Right. Adding more to it. That's I love that, the creative process. I think I heard Sting once say where he wants the best around him, because why wouldn't you? You know, because sometimes an artist doesn't want to be upstaged.
There's some people out there like that too.
But don't go too crazy because I barely hit a G chord. Don't go too crazy on me. You know, but when they have the confidence to say, "I want the best around me," let's really just. Let's make this happen. Let's make this the best. And to me is 10 Summoner's Tale. That album to me is just the best of the best, the best songwriting, the best melodic lines, the best playing. For me, it was just like the best vocals that those things voice on there was like just perfect on that record, you know, just a great, great album. We can make a whole show about that album.
It was a good time.
Another thing that I found out about you, and you and I have something in common, you're really into health, nutrition, and yoga and keeping yourself healthy, right? Now
we try.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm into that stuff too. I help people with nutrition and that type of thing. But was that something that you did for like, especially on tour and stuff like that? Because I have to imagine when you're on these long tours, you have all this bad food sometimes, you got all this craziness out there. So keeping yourself healthy has got to be challenging.
The yoga, I got into yoga when I was around 19, but not, I got into yoga as a sort of an accessory to meditation. I was really involved in transcendental meditation for quite a while. But then the form of yoga that I do now, actually Sting is responsible for teaching me that. And when we started Soul Cages Tour, before 10th Summoner's Tale, we started Soul Cages Tour. Dominic Miller had, I think in the previous year, introduced Sting to a yoga teacher named Danny Paradise.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And Danny teaches, he taught Sting. I think he taught Madonna, some other people. You know. And Sting just gravitated right away. He got into it and just went like full bore into it. Okay. Right. So then the following year when I show up and we're traveling on the road, we're in dressing rooms together and hanging out, and he starts showing me these things and asking me if I know any positions. I knew a basic position. So he goes, well, I'll show you. And he was so into it that he had Danny come on tour with us. Danny Paradise came on tour with us for like, I don't know, maybe
look at that.
A month or something, maybe 6 weeks.
That's so
and Sting goes, well, he's going to be with us this whole time. And so the only thing is, I'll take the first lesson with him in the morning. When I get up, he'll give me the first lesson. After that, if you want to have a lesson with him, it's on me. Just call him up Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, you're kidding. And then I started taking lessons from Danny as well. And
wow.
Yeah, but we definitely kept it. At one point on that, around that period, I think it was around Soul Cages or 10 Summoner's Tales, it was like a yoga camp because they had everybody. We had the technicians, you know, some of the technicians were doing it.
Amazing.
But yeah, that's sort of stayed with me for the rest of my life. You have sometimes some injuries and things where you can't sort of right. do yoga like you right. want to. Like I had right. an issue with my arm for a while, so I couldn't do that. But basically, it's something, once you have that knowledge, you can always return to it.
Very
you
true. Know,
you have to stop for some reason. You can always pick it
love
up.
It. Yeah. I love it. So we're at, time flies whenever we're doing these interviews, George, and I get so upset. I look up to like 50 minutes. I'm like, wait a minute, we just started. So one of the things that we do is we actually try to help people kind of feel better with, you know, the current situation. The last couple of years, a little rough. And with like just motivating words from people that are out there, you know, performing music and being and really inspiring others. Do you have any words or any for our audience moving forward into, you know, our current situation and coming out of it?
I think one of the most powerful things that I've ever heard, it's so simplistic sounding, but if you could practice it, if we put this into practice, the world would come to a standstill and it would be peace. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Absolutely.
That's old English, you know, basically saying if you break it down as a function, don't do anything to anyone else that you wouldn't want done yourself. Don't speak to someone in a tone of voice or with an energy that you wouldn't want to be spoken to. Don't treat anyone in a way that you wouldn't want to be treated yourself. You know, it seems obvious, but if you could just really, if we could fix ourselves to actually practice it from the moment you get up, get out of bed, and from the first interaction with another human being throughout the whole day, if you could maintain that energy in your own spirit as you go about your day and do things with people and talk to people and answer questions and ask questions, you know, and just live your life, I think it would be, you know, I guess like almost like a fantasy, like everything, if we could all just act right for a while, right. You know, how greatly everything would change. But and apart from that, just, you have to be yourself. Be honest, just be your honest, be your real self, be honest with yourself, about yourself, about how you really feel about things, about how what you do and really don't want to do with yourself, you know, and definitely believe in yourself, you know, because you can do what needs to be done, you know, just takes focus and energy. And the other thing too, if you love it, if you love what you're about, that energy of loving it is going to really help you. That's going to get you through tough times, through times where, you know, uncertain times, whatever. But basically, you know, wake up, show up, and do your best. Yeah. That's all anybody can ask of.
It's funny. I have here on my, I always have here, it's a get up, go do, stay focused.
Yeah.
Just go do stuff.
And just kind of piggybacking us as well, especially with your latest record, you know, you have that platform where you can express yourself and right. say what you want to say. Especially, I know your Eyes Wide Open record really has so much of you in there, and your you know, just about your expression and how you feel about certain things and stuff.
Social like that. Consciousness.
Exactly. The social consciousness. It's right. fantastic, by the way. And by the way, I was very surprised. I didn't know that you were such a good singer, by the way. Thank you. Very good vocals on that. But I just wanted to commend you on the record. It's a great
Very record. Kind. I've been working on that a lot. Yeah. I've been working on vocals since I worked with Seal. That's what really pushed me over.
Oh, wow.
He was really inspired me. And he also, his vocal coach gave me some lessons and Seal told me some things about his technically how he sings and different things to do. But yeah, thank you for that.
Such a great voice with Seal has. And the song If is like, whoa. That's a really powerful song. That's I love that song.
Well, Vinny put the fire under that tune, man.
Yeah, I could hear the fire.
He's something else, I gotta tell you.
outrageous, man. He put the pedal all the way to the metal on that tune, especially like the last, I don't know, last like 24 bars.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah. I love it. So, David, thank you so much for doing this. This has been a tremendous honor.
It's been a pleasure, man. I really enjoyed talking with both of you.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
Thank Absolutely. You so much. Really appreciate it. And everyone, we're going to put all the information on the link below.
Yeah. Check out his record. Absolutely. Eyes Wide Open. Amazing. Right. And check out all his music.
And we're just going to just show the record one more time.
There we
go. So you can get it. Please get it and listen to it because it is awesome. I've been listening to it all day today and yesterday, and it's just really fantastic and inspirational. And the music is great. The techniques are great, but the message behind it is also as powerful. So I want to thank you so much for your time. We will definitely hopefully see you again and have a wonderful, wonderful evening. Thank you so much.
You too. Both of you. God bless.
God bless. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Wow. What an inspiring interview, huh? I tell you.
That's just what I'm talking about.
That's right there. There's not much you can say. It speaks for itself.
I just want to say how grateful I am that I have an opportunity to talk to people like that and just to be part of that space and that conversation and just listening to it. You know, the stories of the road and everything is great, but then when you really get the inside and you get to hear really the day-to-day workings and the mindset and the, you know, all that stuff. It's just really inspiring. So
I
want to thank everybody for tuning in. We will see you all again next week. As always, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for George Batista, John Henry Soto, counterparts. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful night. And as always, peace.
Peace.